From what I've seen, you're going to be with Punch on the road, taking a brief hiatus from that to do your own shows and then go back out on the road. I guess that's the life of an in-demand musician these days.
It's feast or famine. Either you're wishing the phone rang more or you're wishing it was a little bit more quiet. This is a busy year. Punch Brothers is doing this podcast in New York for Audible called the Energy Curfew Music Hour, and the new music is part of that project that will eventually lead to a new album, and we're going to go out on the road May and June and play some festivals. That's really exciting. And what's coming up next for me in March are these Noam Pikelny and Friends shows in the Northeast, which I've been looking forward to for a very long time.
You've got your own all-star band now, it seems, with all your pals, Jake Eddy, Dan Klingsberg, Julian Pinelli, and Tio Quale. I'm guessing because the bluegrass community crosses paths a lot at festivals. What drew these guys to you and you to them?
You know, my motives for picking out these bands for recording and playing live Noam Pikelny and Friends shows, they weren't selfish, but I always tried to amass my musical heroes, like try to get the people that I grew up admiring who I don't get to play with regularly, but I adore musically and personally, and put them together in the studio or take them on the road. And, you know, it's been such a gift to be able to play on the road and in the studio with guys like Stuart Duncan and Brian Sutton. I don't think it was that I was unaware 20 years ago of the talent pool that was out there, but I feel like in the last couple of years, going to festivals and camps and just people, you know, sending me a Bandcamp link to check, I've just been completely blown away with the level of artistry of this next generation of musicians that's coming down the pike. And I thought that beginning in 2025 with these Noam and Friends shows, which are really not just a one-shot thing, we're going to do two in March, playing some festivals and going to reconvene later this year. I wanted to bring in the next generation of guys, and I didn't feel like I was making any compromise to call them versus the heroes. The level of playing, the tune craft, the overall musicianship of these guys is just, they blow me away. And I'm so eager to get them together as part of this project because I know they're gonna push me and it'll be a kind of a symbiotic relationship where we'll all be trying to figure out what this project means as a five-piece band. Although it's my name on the marquee for this, whenever I do these shows, I really try to give everybody an opportunity to bring in their own material and to craft a kind of a three-dimensional show that isn't just banjo music from start to finish on every song. And so these players just really knock me out every time I hear them, and I just couldn't resist assembling them, thinking that this could snowball into something that we do more often.
You took a bit of a step out a couple of years ago with Universal Favorite, which was your, I guess it was your fourth solo. First time you actually sang a bit on the record. How has that influenced how your thinking is going on bringing these people together? Because we have two bluegrass shows on this radio station. There's a lot of bluegrass in this region, and people really come out and enjoy the music. And you've established yourself as a very innovative and different instrumentalist on your banjo. I've seen some of the interviews you've done where you can go back over the history and just sort of pull things from people that you admire and who have influenced you into these projects. How are we going to hear that?
I think as far as singing, that was something that I was doing on the solo shows, because when you're up on stage with, you know, just one person, you have one instrument. And so singing actually adds to the palette greatly. And so when I started doing those shows, I intended it to just be fully instrumental. And I thought, you know what, if it's just me playing, we need something to help round out this, you know, this album and the show. And I really enjoy, you know, a huge part of my musicianship is, or at least what I love to do as a musician, is back up a singer. And there's no reason I can't be backing myself up in the same way. And so I decided to go out on a limb and sing on those projects. I don't think I'll be doing nearly as much singing, maybe a couple songs on this tour, but this is mostly going to be an instrumental project. I feel like playing, you know, a radical string band like Punch Brothers has redefined my voice on the instrument and has really informed my kind of technical approach to playing banjo over the last 20 years that makes it a patently different sound, even when I go back to play a standard classic instrumental, whether it's, you know, a fiddle tune or Earl Scruggs tune or Bill Monroe tune, I'm playing that with a bag of tricks that I've kind of honed through playing non-idiomatic music with Punch Brothers over the last 20 years. And so this tour will be an opportunity to revisit some of the original music, kind of more string band original music that I've released across my solo albums, and to work up some of the Bill Monroe and Kenny Baker music that I recorded about a decade ago. I have some new instrumentals of mine that I'm working on. And I've spent a good amount of time mining for kind of more obscure existing instrumentals, whether they're written by Norman Blake or old time tunes. Just there's such a treasure trove of stuff that's still not really out there in the spotlight, like the tunes on a Kenny Baker Plays Bill Monroe record. I really love hearing my favorite musicians interpret existing material and showcase material that, like, you may not hear in a jam session, but it's out there, and kind of unearthing that material and making your own. That's like, it's one of the things I love the most about hearing a player like David Greer or Stuart Duncan play. And so there'll be a bunch of new music like that we'll be working up with the band, and everyone else will be bringing some of their originals as well. So that's the game plan.
I have to inject a little bit that in looking back at your time with the Punch Brothers, you sort of are a foil for Chris Thiele when you're bantering on the stage.
I'm a foil to his genius to have someone fairly mediocre next to him.
But you came into your own when you did that film to promote Universal Favorite, where took disguises kind of and changed things around. My question is, who's going to do that for you when you're on the road with your friends now?
Yeah, that's a good question. Jake Eddy is one of the funniest fellows I've met, and so he has an incredible sense of humor. You know, I think that's just, it's part of the reason to go to a live show is obviously for the music being played, but you get a better sense of the people you're seeing when you kind of have that one-way conversation in between songs with the audience. And so there's always some kind of shenanigans when I'm doing my solo shows or even Element Friends show. So that'll be fun to have a new group of guys up there with me, bearing with me.
you mentioned trying to pull out some gems from the past. The banjo has a very long history, more than most people, I would guess, probably know from its origins in Africa and then Europe and then being brought over to the Western world. You seem to have embraced the diversity of the sound of the instrument. And listening at Universal Favorite again, you did a lot of different things that I don't think people would think about. And that's nicely translated through the Punch Brothers a lot because of the talent of all the guys that you're playing with. What's your process on trying to bring the different sounds of the banjo out? Because you do so many different things. And I know you can talk a lot about the technical stuff through your teaching and whatnot. It's kind of, to me, like you're inventing things, but you're very confident that you're bringing them into the right tone.
Well, thank you. I think the banjo is really good at doing that very banjo-y thing that everybody can imagine in their head. When you think of bluegrass banjo, you think of the banjo, people think of fast banjo music. You might even conjure up the image of a car chase or something like that. The banjo is so great at that, but there are so many other sounds that are possible on the banjo. The banjo can be mournful, it can be introspective, it could be played quietly. Just the difference in sound of a banjo versus the results in just barely hitting the strings versus really driving into the strings to project it across the room. There are just so many different voices the instrument can have. And when I'm sitting down to write music or arrange music, I'm typically gravitate towards the things that sound new to me. I've never heard a banjo do that. Like, what's there? Let me mine that idea. I find it much harder to sit down and write a banjo instrumental that kind of fits the archetype of that, imagined sound of a banjo, fast banjo in our head. I was joking, the car chase. But if I sat down and try to write something in that template, I almost always just hit a wall within an hour or so of me. It's feeling like, wait, I've heard too many things that sound like this. It's not different enough. And if it's not different enough, what's wrong with Pike County Breakdown? Like, that's a pretty righteous song. And so sometimes I can get self-conscious of throwing my hat in the ring if they're banjo tunes within that template. When I find something that catches my ear and my interest, you know, like whether it was the chord progression to that song Waveland of mine, which like almost has like, if you take away all the fast playing on it, it sounds more like a lullaby, fast picking on it. And then when you start doing the fast kind of arpeggiated picking, it caught my attention because I stumbled into it. I thought, wait, I've never done that before. Wait, I don't know if I've ever heard anyone else do that. And it's not enough for something just to be new, because just because it's new and novel doesn't mean that it's good. But I've always dedicated my time towards seeking out those sounds, those parts that just, I think, just showcase the voice of the banjo in a different way. And I think there's a certain element of that that even exists when I'm playing kind of classic bluegrass. And that was the justification behind Noam Pikelny plays Kenny Baker plays Bill Monroe, is that, you know, we're going to play Lonesome Moonlight Waltz, which has been recorded 1,000 times. But we're going to turn the microphones up really loud on the banjo, and I'm barely going to hit the strings, and I'm going to bend into every melody note, almost as if it was like a Stratocaster. And the end result is like a completely different glimpse of that song and a completely different glimpse of how the banjo can sound. And so I think it's at this point in my career, it's all so kind of wound together, whether it's writing new music or arranging old music, you know, an angle of justification of like, if it's something that exists before, like, what is the reason for this song to be recorded again? What am I going to do to make this my own, to make it new? And if I'm writing music, you know, there's plenty of great music out there. What is the argument on this song? Like, what's the angle? And so that's been my approach, for better or worse.
Doing covers has been a part of people getting into bands and enjoying music for a long time. And the whole point is to make it recognizable, but make it yours, as embracing the song, but letting people know that this is my version of things.
The term cover is a pretty foreign term within the world of, you know, bluegrass or old time or, you know, classical music. Nobody goes to a symphony and says, well, yeah, they were covering Mozart, you know, like you played Mozart. Or if you go to a bluegrass show and you heard, you know, Angel Band, it's like, oh yeah, they played a Stanley Brothers song. But this idea of cover is kind of more of a pop type term. And I think there's always been something about traditional folk music, that traditional music, folk music, roots music, I think one of the tenets of those styles, I mean, they're not disparate, but like, whether you call it roots or traditional music or Americana, I think one of the things that is baked in is that it is connected to the tradition that came before it. It's not created with a decision to like to cut off ties with the world that came before you. I think that's one of the things about folk music, I think, is when you hear it, you feel, whether consciously or subconsciously, you feel this connection to the music that came before it. And that's typically the music I love the most, are things that are breaking new ground, but you could still kind of follow that trail of breadcrumbs to the influences and the music that came before it.